Throughout the 2000s and early 2010s, horror films seemed to be aimed at audiences with an appetite for gore and the obviously paranormal. Franchises like Saw, Hostel, Sinister, and The Conjuring reigned supreme. Jump scares were everywhere, and audiences looking to be psychologically shaken were often left disappointed and wanting more. By the mid-2010s, cerebral horror had arrived. Movies that challenged audiences to think about the larger ideas that drive them started to show up in cinemas. Brilliant filmmakers like Karen Kusama, Ari Aster, and Robert Eggers challenged audiences to decode the deeper meanings in their films the same way they might interpret precious works of art. At the heart of these films was a deep, visceral dread. And in addition to the monsters on the screen, we saw unexplainable and complex symbols that chilled us to the bone. Movies of the horror renaissance haven't just scared us, they've stayed with us, they've haunted us, even if we don't know why. Listen as I'm joined by Freudian psychologist and horror expert Mary Wilde as we preview the movies to be analyzed in the first series of Dark Overtones. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first inaugural episode of Dark Overtones. I am and will be your host, Kurt Braddock. And today we're going to go over the entirety of Series 1. We're going to go over the fantastic movies that I've chosen to include in Series 1, which, as I said in the trailer for Series 1, covers what I call the horror renaissance of the 2010s and the early 2020s. Now, I am very, very lucky in that someone who I would say, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, was an inspiration for starting this pod, is joining me today to talk about the movies that we'll be going over in the course of Series 1. I'm joined with the wonderful, you will know her if you listen to the Evolution of Horror podcast or other horror podcasts, Mary Wilde. I am so happy to have you here to talk about these movies, and I'm so lucky to have you here to talk about these movies. Welcome.
What a wonderful introduction, Kurt. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure and honor to be here on your first episode.
It is the least I could do, considering that you've had me on your podcast, and I've had a ton of fun on your podcast a couple of times and hope to come back. But before we get started in the 12 movies, we're going to talk about 12 movies. We're going to dedicate a short amount of time to each one to give a little taste to the listener for each of these. But before we get that, for people who aren't familiar with you, or even those who are and who are charmed with you and want to know more about you, I'd like to have my guests talk a little bit about themselves, tell them where you're coming from and kind of your background. So can you just talk a little bit about yourself, the work that you do, and maybe how you became interested in horror in the first place? Because if I understand correctly, you are a Freudian expert by training.
Yes, that's correct. So I got into podcasting via lecturing. I delivered a public lecture series at the Freud Museum in London for 11 years. And I developed this, I guess you could say, like a formula of applying Freudian, predominantly Freudian, but also Lacanian and Jungian psychoanalysis to the study of films. And, you know, that very, very diverse umbrella of categories. So, like, mostly thrillers and documentaries, science fiction, but also horror.
Can I don't want to make it a habit of interrupting, but I always find myself when I'm listening to guests and listening to you specifically, I become interested in what you're saying. How did when you say you're interested in Freudian and Jungian and other kinds of psychology, is it that you were just interested in horror as a fan and you happen to notice that these frameworks, these ideas kind of map on horror very well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I felt that what we're witnessing on film is really like a representation or an illustration of the theory. I'm a very visual person, and my brain just grasps theory much more rapidly when I see it visually represented. And cinema is a great and unique art form and medium to facilitate theoretical understanding. So when I was developing my lecture series, when I, you know, over the course of the decade plus that I was doing it, I got into podcasting and then connected with Mike Munzer at the Evolution of Horror podcast, who really initially brought me in as a recurring contributor, but then he produced and commissioned me to do a series of segments called Wild About Fantastic, Horror.
Which is exactly what introduced me to your work and got me on your podcast, was the Wild About Horror segments, which drew me to your podcast itself, which is called...
My podcast is just my name. It is Mary Wild, and you can find me on Patreon. And while on that platform, I've been doing a number of different strands, looking at the works of directors, so like deep dives on directors, right, including a couple of horror names such as David Lynch and David Cronenberg.
You love Lynch so much.
I do. I'm a Lynchian woman.
What is, I mean, we're going to get into the movies in a bit, but I do want people to understand kind of, I want them to get in your brain. So like, what would be your favorite Lynch if you had to pick one?
It's an embarrassment of riches. There's so many to pick from, but my personal one that I always return to as number one is Mulholland Drive.
Okay, that's the one that I would go to, because I am very much not a Lynchian. I'm going to dive into some Lynch films, I think, in subsequent series, but yeah. A lot of his stuff I just don't get. But Mulholland Drive is one that I watched, and it was in my running for the worst movie I've ever seen the first time I saw it. The second time I saw it, I was like, okay, maybe I missed something. The third time I saw it, I absolutely loved it. So, wow. So I completely agree with that.
Oh, what a journey. I love to hear that.
I can't get into things what was the movie that we discussed? You recommended it, and then I went and watched it. It's Lost Highway. Lost Highway.
Oh, yes.
You love Lost Highway, too.
I do, very much. What did you I mean, you also had an appreciation for it from memory.
I did. I enjoyed Lost Highway. I can appreciate how Lynch takes kind of a linear narrative and really messes with the viewer in a way where it becomes more difficult to understand, and it takes some work to get what he's trying to say. So I appreciated that about it quite a bit.
Yes, exactly. I think he really puts viewers, you know, through the ringer.
I would say that is very, very accurate. Mm-hmm. All right, so you did some lecturing. You did lecture for 11 years, and from there you got connected to Mike on Evolution of Horror and started doing the Wild About Horror podcast, or Wild About Horror segment.
Yes.
What are you working on now? Because I know that you've been making moves lately, including a book.
Thank you for mentioning it. I've got a few different things on the go. Of course, I still produce my work on Patreon, but in addition to that, I've now moved my lecture series from the Freud Museum exclusively to Morbid Anatomy, which I think is much more horror adjacent, as the name would suggest. And so I feel it's a better match. It's a better alignment for me. In addition to that, I am writing a book. I'm in the final stretches of the editing stages of that.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. That is actually it's sort of a compendium of what I've been writing in my scripts for Wild About Horror with the segment on Mike's podcast. So essentially what had happened is that I never thought of myself as a writer per se. My media are, you know, podcasting and lecturing. I'm sort of watcher and a talker, not a reader and a writer, as I like to say always. But what happened is that when Mike commissioned me to do these segments, over time, I was scripting them, of course. They're not ad-libbed. They are scripted.
Right.
And intentionally performed in the ASMR style.
Is that right? I don't think I even knew that.
Yes.
No wonder I was drawn to them.
Thank you. That was the whole sort of vision for it. Over time, I had just ended up with these mini scripts, and it occurred to me that maybe it is worthwhile to collect them, you know, sort of stitch them together as part of a book, so that it could actually just be like a volume that collects these things. And I worked with a fantastic editor for Routledge, who supervises the psychoanalysis division of the publication company. Mm-hmm. And I believe that she's sort of like a guardian angel, truly, because she's had so much patience with me, so much, offered so much guidance and support, encouragement. I take strength and vitality from her vision, and she inspires me. So it's been a fantastic collaboration with her.
That is the mark of a good commissioning editor, that they actually make you feel like your work is valued and it's going to be a good contribution, which I have no doubt yours is going to be.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that. It means a lot coming from you, because I really respect your work a lot.
I mentioned in the intro and in the trailer, for those that are listening, the kind of work that I do, that I am a professor. But if any of you have Googled me since then, I mean, now might be the time to mention the work that I do. I do not work in film. I do not work in psychoanalysis. I have nothing to do with horror at all. My research is on violent extremism and political violence. The company that I hope to keep one day among fellow podcasters in the horror community is nothing like what I do. I'm a completely different bird in that respect. But
wow.
I love this genre. I really do. Like, it's the first genre that I grew up with. I mentioned in the trailer, and I'd be curious to hear about your intro to it too, Mary, that my intro to horror was going to the video store when I was 5-6 years old with my parents. We would always go on Friday night. We'd go to TNS Video in Lumberton, New Jersey, in the States, on Friday night, and we'd pick two movies. And my parents would pick a movie, my brother and my sister would pick a movie, and I would wander off into the horror section to look at the box art, because I loved being scared by the box art, and that was what really got me interested in horror. Do you remember the first thing that really got you into horror?
Yeah, I mean, you and I have very parallel entry points into horror, because that was literally my experience too. At the video store, the one that I went to when I was a kid, the very first one when I was 8 years old, was Video International in Montreal.
Okay.
Although it was intended to be a French title.
I was going to say, was it Video International?
Video International.
way better than I could do it. I only took French for a semester.
You're not bad.
I can count to 100, and I can say that's there are two dogs, but that's about it.
What more do you need? But yes, we have very, very similar entry points, because I too found my way always back to the horror section, admiring the cover art of the VHS cassettes, and the film that always intrigued me and that I was so morbidly fascinated by was not allowed to rent at all, but would still continuously like study it and like just try to understand what it meant, was the cover for Pieces, the slasher from I think 1983, I believe.
I don't remember. I remember the movie. I don't remember the box art.
The box art is basically a woman that's been cobbled together, like stitched up from body parts of multiple different women.
Okay.
So you actually see like the sewing points, you know.
There was the movie Body Parts was like that too. I forget the actor, but he got an arm sewed on or something, and he became a killer because of the arm.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah. Similar box art.
Similar. Yes, exactly. And I just, it's a funny thing. I don't recall being afraid of it. I was more like curious, desperately curious to know what, you know, how did they create this new woman? And she's an amalgamation of different women. And that concept fascinated me. I didn't have the words to express my curiosity. I just wanted to watch the movie. Later, as an adult, when I did watch it, I was bitterly disappointed because it's not a very good film. But but I do recall my little sister being in the video store with me. She's 5 years younger than me. So she was a three-year-old, and she was looking at Care Bear movies, like the cartoons, perfectly age-appropriate.
Care Bears 2, The Next Generation, underrated movie.
Very cute. And she even had a little Care Bear, you know, in tote. It was clutching her bear. And I ran over to her with pieces in my hand and said, "Look at this. Isn't this cool?" And she just started crying. She was very upset.
Mary Wilde corrupting the youth from an early age. I do remember the first one that I saw, and I had a similar experience, and I won't go into detail because it was so disappointing, was the movie Graveyard Shift, which was mm-hmm. I think the cover art was a skull with like a hard hat on, and it was touted as Stephen King's Graveyard Shift, and I think the movie was so bad that he later demanded that his name be taken off of it, because mm-hmm. it's just a bad. I think the movie had something to do with rats, if I remember right. I can't even really remember, but it is so bad. Yeah. Okay, so we know that you've been in this space for quite some time, so you are. It's safe to say you're an absolute expert in this space, and it's great to have you talk about these movies that we're going to go over. So what we're going to do is go through these movies, and I had, and I think anybody who's podcasted or tried to do anything creative says the best laid plans of mice and men, right? I had a series of movies that I was going to do in chronological order, and it was all nice, neat, and organized, and it turns out that the guests that I'm having on, they are available sometimes, not available other times. So the order in which we're going was the order they were originally meant to appear, episodes were meant to drop, but that is no longer the case. So we're going to talk about the movies in the order in which I originally put them.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that the first movie that we talk about is the first movie that's dropping next week. But with that caveat, let me ask you first. Well, first, you know what? I'll give a preview of the movies that are going to be in this first series before we begin talking about them. So, dear listener, the things you can expect in series one, as I said, they're from the horror, what I call, or has been called, the horror renaissance of the 2010s and the 2020s, when horror kind of became adult again. And we started seeing really adult themes in some of the movies that came out in that time space. So, with that in mind, the movies that I'll be covering in this first series, there'll be 12 of them, and they were originally ordered The Witch, It Follows, The Invitation, which Mary Wilde will be joining me for, mm-hmm. The Killing of a Sacred Deer, It Comes at Night, Get Out, A Dark Song, Hereditary, Mandy, Midsommar, Pet Sematary, which I will argue is not necessarily, or nor should it be, considered part of the horror renaissance. It was pretty bad, in my opinion. But my brother will be on that episode, and it is a very formative movie for both of us. So, because I get to decide what movies go in, it goes in. And finally, Saint Maud. Those are the ones that we'll be covering over the course of this episode of this series. So, with that said, Mary, let's start with The Witch. How do you feel about this movie generally? Did you like it? Did you dislike it? And how do you feel it? I consider it to be almost the first of the movies that appeared in this time frame.
Yes. I was taken aback by The Witch. I went to see it at a press screening in London prior to its general release. And for me, what I take away is just the sheer astonishment among even the critics in the audience, because I think it was released at a time where there was really nothing like it. So it was very unique, and it took everyone by surprise, including me. I love the ending.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the guests that I'm having on, and I mentioned it in the trailer, the guests, I will always have two guests for every episode, except for this one in which it's just really a preview episode for the movies we're going through. But the guest that I have, the expert guest, is an expert in kind of how the movie relates to kind of feminine empowerment. And how that's born through the movie. The other guest, my friend, she considers herself to be a witch. So we will getting her viewpoints on that movie, which we just watched the other day. She saw it for the first time the other day. So what was it about the ending? Well, you know what? I don't want to spoil the ending for anybody, but can you say what it was about the ending that you enjoyed?
What I loved about it experientially is the radical tonal shift, and it's a great climax. Let's put it that way.
I agree.
You know what I mean? And I just really like that feeling of being taken by surprise and by something like that. And it was also my very first time, I think, seeing Anya Taylor-Joy.
I think for me as well.
Yeah, and I felt that she has such a great charisma on screen. Of course, she's now, you know, gone on to become like a Hollywood A-lister.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. She's a very talented actor. But it was nice to see like a fresh performer be just instantly so ravishing and charismatic and very subtle. She's a very good, subtle horror actress. And I just thought, you know, when I remember seeing her and instantly knowing she's going to be huge, because she sort of just emerged on the scene like, you know, Venus on a half shell, like fully formed, you know, and
that's a great analogy.
Yeah. So I was very impressed by it.
I also don't think it's necessarily a mistake or coincidence that The Witch was her first major movie, because the nature of the plot of that movie leads her to the center of what the movie was trying to say. And on the basis of her coming to that center, like she becomes the main player. So I agree that it's no surprise she became a star, but I think The Witch had no small part in that.
Yeah,
I don't want to say more for people who haven't seen it. If you haven't seen it, absolutely go see it. But for my money, this is the first movie that I saw where I was surprised by the adult themes in the movie, and where the director, Robert Eggers, I believe, didn't treat the horror audience as being dumb or something that needed to be kind of exposition to death for the audience. He left you guessing until the very end, and the very end, there's absolutely a payoff for it. So I absolutely love this movie.
Yes, agreed.
So following from that, no pun intended, the second movie that I'll be covering or that we'll be going over, It Follows, another one that I think treats its audience very, very, in terms of, it treats them as though they are adults, but the content in the movie is really focuses on what it's like to transition from being a teenager to young adulthood.
Yes. Yes, I agree. It's a great metaphor or allegory for the experience of, as you say, sort of developing into an adult, coming of age, concerns and preoccupations, and this idea of, you know, the central story of a young woman being pursued by a supernatural entity after her very first sexual encounter. Mm-hmm. You can imagine myself being a Freudian, that will immediately, get sort of, you know, appear as a blip on the radar, like, wow, this is interesting, you know? And it's, I really like this idea of emphasizing the entity as something that is unknowable, but that is ultimately very haunting, and something that she can't shake off. I like the way that it mysteriously links up with the nature of sexual subjectivity, which I feel like Freud, if he were alive today and he saw It Follows, he would say, this is exactly what I'm talking about in a German accent, you know? But you know what I mean? Like, it's very, it's doing something cinematically, which is very rare, which is to visually represent something unconscious.
And something that the guests that I have for that day, on that day, I have two individuals who have written an article related to It Follows, where they will discuss how the major assumption about the movie is that the it is sexually transmitted infections. And mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to be said for that. Obviously, that's part of the filmmaker's idea about the movie. But the people that I'm talking to, they wrote an article arguing that what the movie is about isn't necessarily STIs or STDs, but it's mm-hmm. about rape culture and how rape is apologized for. And I had a really interesting discussion with them a couple of weeks ago that we're going to elaborate on in the episode, where the individual, for those who haven't seen it, this isn't really ruining anything, but I won't go mm-hmm. into too much detail. The individual who exposes the main character to the stalking entity, he essentially rapes her. And then mm-hmm. he becomes a sympathetic character later in the movie. So it's all these people to whom I'm having on argue that the premise of the movie, in addition to kind of the repercussions of sexual activity, is also that we apologize for rape and we apologize mm. for sexual aggression, which I think is going to be absolutely fascinating to talk about.
Oh, absolutely. And it's such an important conversation to have and to, you know, actually normalize the expression of very complicated feelings around this. You know, these things need to be given a platform to discuss further.
Mm-hmm. And I think It Follows is a great medium for that, because mm-hmm. the individual who I said more or less rapes the main character, Jay, he's mm-hmm. under threat as well. So it puts you in a position where the movie wants you to sympathize with them, which puts you in a really uncomfortable position exactly. if you consider what he did to be rape, which I consider it to be. Mm-hmm. In any event, I don't want to spoil too much for those who haven't seen it. If you haven't, absolutely go see it. Yeah. But the next one that was on my list was the Mary Wilde episode, which was the one that you specifically chose. I gave you a choice of all the movies that you wanted to see, and the one you chose was The Invitation. Can you say why you chose The Invitation?
The Invitation for me is probably my second favorite film of that decade after Black Swan. Wow. In the horror genre. I think that it is such a subtle but devastating examination of society and civilization. Mm-hmm. For me, it's a really good portrayal of, I suppose you could say, what Freud talks about, the tension between our innermost feelings and unconscious, unresolved conflicts mm-hmm. and internalized superego or the expectations of society.
Oh, I cannot wait to talk to you about this movie.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's one of the greatest, well, very Freudian take on the tensions, you know, in group psychology, in a sense. Yeah. So, and I just think, you know, the cast is amazing. It's in such a very simple setting inside a house. All of the action takes place in this house in Los Angeles. And it's such a proof that you are able to conjure up truly like a great horror effect on a minimal budget. You don't need fancy effects. You don't need, you know, crazy, you know, concepts. Mm-hmm. You just need a really good story mm-hmm. and great direction. So, yeah, I love this movie. It's wonderful.
And an absolute cracker of an ending.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think, for my money, is up there with The Mist as being one of my favorite horror endings of all time. Like, it's such a good ending. And something else that really resonated with me with The Invitation was it's also a really good meditation on grief and how grief yes. can affect people in different ways. Because you have the main character who's dealing with it kind of via avoidance, but then you have some other characters who are dealing with it in very, very more manifestly destructive ways. So I really do think that this is a fantastic choice for you, because I can't wait to dive into the Freudian elements of the movie. It's going to be so good.
Yes, I can't wait to talk to you about it. I mean, Karin Kusama, an amazing director. I love her so much. And Logan Marshall Green, one of the greatest actors of his generation, truly.
I didn't know much about Green until I saw, weirdly enough, I'm not a fan of M. Night Shyamalan at all, but he was in that movie Devil. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he was in Devil, which is actually a good little movie. It's a little Hitchcockian type movie. It's actually very good. Not this season, but if you're interested in a quick little 90-minute horror movie, a fun little jaunt, I would say Devil's a very good one.
I agree.
That said, let's move on to another one, which is in a line of kind of strange Colin Farrell movies. this is The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which... a movie which is really, really darkly funny, but also very, very tragic in a lot of ways. And I think it's meant to be. I believe this movie is meant to be a retelling of an ancient Greek tragedy, if I'm remembering right. What do you think of The Killing of a Sacred Deer?
I think that, for me, this is one of Yorgos Lanthimos' best films. I wouldn't say that I'm a general, like, super fan of his, in terms of his broad... offering.
The Lobster was bad. Like he did. So that's what I was alluding to with Colin Farrell. This line of weird, yes. Colin Farrell, but he did The Lobster. The Lobster is not a horror movie. I was very intrigued by it. I didn't like it, but I liked this quite a bit.
Yes, it is. This was really impressive. Truly, like, worth a watch. It's very absurdist, and I do like absurdism very much, especially in horror. Mm-hmm. The Greek tragedy that you referred to is by Euripides. Oh,
you are a fountain of good knowledge.
So I think it's always interesting, especially because Lanthimos is Greek himself. To borrow from his own culture is always fascinating and interesting. I am a fan of the entire cast, particularly Nicole Kidman. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's sort of about this cardiac surgeon who introduces his family to a teenage boy with a connection to his past, after which they mysteriously begin to fall ill. So it is very, yeah, it is. I just love the starkness with which it is shot. There's a lot of clean lines, a lot of long takes. Mm-hmm. It's very stripped down. It's very essentialist. And if you're in the mood for that, it really hits.
It really does. And I would say there are parts, even in the, what I would say is really the climax of the movie, that are, I couldn't help but laugh, because there are parts that are just completely ludicrous, as you said, absurdist at the end. Mm. And this is the first time that I saw Barry Keoghan, I think is how you pronounce his last name, Keoghan. Mm-hmm. So this is the first experience I had in watching him, and I immediately saw how talented he was. And this is from somebody who absolutely hated Saltburn. But I absolutely hated Saltburn. But I really like Barry Keoghan, because a movie like this, a movie which, if this podcast does anything, that I'm going to do a series on dark satire and black comedy. So if you've seen The Banshees of Inisherin, which is fantastic, he was fantastic in that. He is so talented. And there are scenes in this movie where, again, ludicrous, absurd, but he is absolutely chilling in it.
Yes, Barry is an actor with an enormous range.
I should say he can give a glance and seem completely evil and nefarious, and he can also dance around a mansion with his ass
naked.
Hanging out. Yeah, exactly. That's Saltburn.
Exactly. Yeah.
Worth a watch, but not my favorite.
Impressive range.
Yeah. moving on from Barry's bare ass. one that you actually haven't seen, but one that we discussed kind of off tape here, was It Comes at Night. Mm-hmm. So It Comes at Night, if you're unfamiliar, is a movie about a family who is holed up in a cabin in the woods after some unspecified disaster, and an individual from another family, they run into each other. And the former family, they trust this individual. They come to trust this individual. It takes a while, but the second individual's family moves in, and they all live happily for a while until eventually trust begins to break down in this closed space. So the discussion that I'll be having that day will surround how the movie is meant to be a metaphor for the United States in post-Trump America, where we're so polarized, how we don't trust one another, and how that can tear us all apart at the seams. So I know you haven't seen it, Mary, but does the idea of a group being holed up and coming to distrust one another, does that resonate with you at all? It sounds kind of like The Invitation a bit.
Yes. From your description of it, you really sold it to me. I am now very curious about it. It actually really reminds me from what you said about sort of close quarters and a lot of people being cooped up together. It makes me think immediately of, and I always reference this movie, Luis Buñuel's film Exterminating Angel.
I'm not familiar with that, but it doesn't surprise me that you are. What is that about?
It is a surrealist film. And it is this sort of social satire, but it's about a group of people who are quite well-to-do. They're sort of upper middle class, and they attend a dinner party. At first, everything is normal. And then, for some unknown reason, the guests are unable to leave the house. Like, there's nothing stopping them. There's no barrier to exit. Like, there's no one physically forcing them to stay. But they simply cannot leave. And then hours go by, days, weeks, months, and they're just there, you know, running out of food to eat, running out of water. And the whole thing just collapses. And this is the idea of civilization being such a fragile construction that it can so easily fall apart and collapse. And it has to do with proximity, long-term proximity, and being cooped up in close quarters. So you're immediately making me think of Buñuel.
And yeah, so that's very much what this is as well. And the connection to the kind of the American political body at the moment, it's definitely there. But the thing that drew me to the movie, and this, I believe, was The Witch was the first movie where I was like, ooh, what's this A24 thing? And then It Comes at Night was the second one that I was like, I got to see this because The Witch was amazing. So I saw this, and it gets at the thing that scares me the most about like post-apocalyptic fiction. It isn't like the zombies. It isn't what's going to kill you. It's the breakdown of societal norms and the breakdown of trust among people, because it really is tenuous. We really are just, you know, naked apes, as somebody put it once.
Yes, exactly. And that's why the horror genre is so apt at capturing that primordial fear. It gives us a language and a lexicon to attach to that, to these experiential realities. So, I look forward to your discussion on this for sure. Sounds great.
And speaking of societal divisions and how society breaks down, we move on then from political division to racial division in Jordan Peele's Get Out. I'll be honest, Get Out was not my favorite movie. Like, a lot of people really heaped praise upon it and really loved it. I thought it was good. I actually prefer Us to Get Out. Mm-hmm. But Get Out belongs in this list because of how important it was, I think, in the 2010s, and the importance and the message that it conveyed to audiences. What did you think of Get Out?
I saw it at the cinema. I thought it was a riot. I do think that you are right about Us being superior. But this is worth including, as you say, in your program, because it was such a conversation starter. It was an absolute blockbuster at the cinema with a budget of $4.5 million and a box office of $255 million for a horror movie. That's insane.
Yeah.
You know, it is such a profitable film, and that is a very rare phenomenon for horror. for it to become such a mainstream sensation.
And that was mostly, that was word of mouth too, wasn't it? Like word of mouth has got around about it. And that's why I saw it.
Same. It wasn't because of any marketing strategy. It was literally just word of mouth. And I do appreciate certain aspects of it, in particular, the idea of a therapist misbehaving. I do find that interesting.
As a friend, that doesn't surprise me.
Exactly. Of course, the very important theme of the film being, you know, racism and white supremacy, mm-hmm. always very, very crucial to, you know, to poke holes in, but put under a microscope.
I think what made this special, though, is that there are a million movies on racism and a million even horror movies on racism. But I think what made Get Out stand out, and I will give it credit for this, is that it tackled kind of that polite white racism, that right. polite, like, I would have voted for Obama three times if I, like, the you know, the trying to mm-hmm. placate African-Americans racism, that kind of thing, which I think is a very subtle thing. Mm. That Jordan Peele absolutely nailed in this movie.
Oh, well said. That is spot on. It's the insidiousness of this almost imperceptible racism that is mm-hmm. actually so damaging. Mm-hmm. And the way that he captures it, and the whole, you could say the mechanism that is at work in Get Out, which I won't mention, I'll leave it for your for your wider discussion on it, but it is so clever, and I really like that conceit a lot. So it is very entertaining as well. And yeah, big fan of Jordan Peele in general. I'm looking forward to his next offering.
Has he announced his next one? Because Us, I think Us wouldn't have been as good without Lupita Nyong'o. Like, she would, that a couple of months ago, Mike Munzer of Evolution of Horror put out a call for what are your top like 100 horror performances, and I think I listed her performance in Us as like my number 3 ever.
Yes, definitely.
It was so good. It was so good.
She is remarkable. Mm-hmm. She's wow, what an incredible presence on the screen, and she's so convincing. She really is extraordinary. I did hear that Jordan Peele he announced his new project, which I believe will be coming out in 2026. I don't know why. That's a very strange teaser, like 2 years away.
Okay, better be good.
It better be good, because my expectations are going to be like stack high by the time 2026 rolls around.
Yeah, if I have to sit around and wait for one, it better be good.
Yeah, so that might not be the greatest marketing strategy of all time, to announce something for 2026. But yeah, he is an interesting director, and I look forward to see what else he comes out with.
Yeah, same. So I'm gonna put two together here, because they tackle similar themes, albeit differently, and I'll say with one with a bit more skill than the other. So A Dark Song and later on Pet Sematary. They both relate to the death of a child. They both relate to, I guess, the attempted resurrection of that child. So there are overlapping themes here in terms of the way the movies tackle grief and the way that parents deal with the loss of a child. Do you see similarities between these two, or do you see differences? And if so, like, what are they? My argument would be that A Dark Song is, I mean, forgive the redundancy, but it's darker than Pet Sematary is. Yeah. There's a bit of a playfulness to Pet Sematary, the movie. The book is absolutely crushing, but how do you perceive these kind of movies that deal with the loss of a child?
It's a really good pairing, actually, because they are so different as films, but their central theme and motif does revolve around, obviously, the grieving of a child, the loss of a child. Mm-hmm. They're approaching it in very different ways. I think that with A Dark Song, the subgenre is more sort of like the occult, mm-hmm. Which I think that without giving too much away about the film, more speaking generally about it, I would say that I think it touches more on what happened psychologically, or speculation around the response of a parent.
I think so too.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and to jump in, the funny, I'm glad you mentioned it's the that A Dark Song more touches upon the occult, because my friend guest that day is the same friend who will be on for The Witch, because she'll be talking about the occult and things like that that day. So we're going to be getting into the ins and outs of the occult and the kind of things that the movie got right, the things it got wrong, the details of, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but the spell casting that go on in A Dark Song. Whereas Pet Sematary, like I said, there's more of a playfulness to it. And there's more of a playfulness to most Stephen King stuff. But I would say that we're going to cover both movies. We're going to cover I believe it was 1989 movie and the 2019 version. Neither of them, I think, get right what King did in the novel. We're going to cover that, but they do cover some pretty heavy ground.
Yes, I think so. I think you are correct to say that Pet Sematary is more of a playful engagement with the horrors of grief, particularly with children involved. Mm-hmm. It seems to be more around kind of in the realm of the fantastical and the return of the repressed, you know, zombies, reanimated corpses, that kind of thing. Yep. I feel like it's more of a wish fulfillment exercise than A Dark Song. I feel like The Dark Song seems more like a fever dream, seems more like...
Oh, what a great call.
Do you know what I mean?
Fantastic call. Fantastic call that. And I would say A Dark Song feels like there's more... I mean, there's not. Even if you look at it in terms of the number of people involved, A Dark Song feels more consequential than Pet Sematary. It feels as though there's more going on. There's bigger forces at play. That's not to say that doesn't happen in Pet Sematary. And I've got to give a shout to the book. If you haven't read Pet Sematary, please do so, because the chapters after the child dies are some of the most, and even people who've lost children and people who still have children, they read those. It's impossibly difficult to read. I think King famously said that he wasn't even going to publish Pet Sematary, but he owed his publisher another manuscript and it sat in the drawer because he didn't want to read it again because he scared himself too much with the manuscript. But he needed one more manuscript. He's like, here, take this one, and it ended up being what it became. So it's a bit of a shame that Pet Sematary, the movies, didn't live up to the book. But I think A Dark Song touches upon some of the things that King did in the book in ways that Pet Sematary, the movies, didn't.
Great call. Yes, yeah. I agree.
All right, so a little more occult, but again, we can give something away. We'll try not to give it away, but for my money, what is the scariest movie, I think, of the last, say, I mean, I'd say since the turn of the century. It's the most scared I've ever been in a theater since, I'm almost ashamed to say, the Blair Witch Project, because we were all innocent children in 99 and we thought it was actually true, but all the same. The scariest movie that I think is the scariest movie since 2000 or 99 is Hereditary, where Toni Collette was absolutely robbed of an Oscar.
Agreed.
Yeah, but that's one that I'm very excited to talk about just because of how terrifying it was.
Oh, yeah, I agree. My first, obviously, everyone's first ever encounter with Ari Aster.
Oh, yeah.
This incredible virtuoso director at such a tender age, making these extraordinary movies. Yes, I agree. This one really surprised me. It was tonally unlike anything I'd ever seen before. So innovative. It put a new spin on the concept of a jump scare, because there's one specific thing that happens, and I think you may know what I'm referring to.
Everybody who's seen it knows what you're referring to.
Yeah. I mean, wow. that really, it's just because you're sort of lulled into this state of, you know, kind of complacency in a way, the way that that scene is set up. Mm-hmm. And when the action occurs very suddenly, I felt like kind of out of sorts. It really ontologically disturbed me. And Toni Collette is, she steals every single scene she's in. Mm-hmm. And there are some really interesting, patterns of psychodrama within the family. There's so many unspoken things going on. Even sort of this sub-layer of significance that threatens to overshadow the already excellent script. So
yeah,
there's a lot of competing forces in the film. And then the final scene I thought was really, really weird and like just and really creepy. And it's such a great, effective horror film.
I love every frame of this movie. Like, it's the jump scare that you're talking about, the mm-hmm. one that you don't expect. Like, this was a masterclass in how a movie is advertised and then what you get from it. But but not in a way that it's disappointing, because so many times we see a movie advertised one way and then you get another. This went in a direction that was better than what they were promising, or the better than what Astor was promising. In terms of the ending and the way it tied together so many of the themes throughout the movie, like, this might be my favorite horror movie ever, just because of how scary it was. And like you mentioned, the overlapping themes, just the straight up horror elements are scary enough. But there is, as you said, there's a family drama scene in particular. And again, for those who have seen the movie, they'll know what I'm talking about. It is a very heated conversation among members of the family. And it itself, because it's so consequential, it adds to the fear and the dread, because people should be able to rely on members of their family for comfort, for warmth. And in this scene, that's all stripped away. So there is nothing nice about this movie. There are no redeeming elements that are going to save you from the dread you're going to feel if you haven't seen it. But this is one that I'm so psyched to talk about, just because it's one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're bound to have a very fascinating conversation, and I look forward to hearing it.
So we're going to stick with Ari Aster and jump around a little bit. Another of my favorite horror movies of the last 20 years, Midsommar. Mm-hmm. And am I right, you weren't as big a fan of Midsommar as I was? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
No, I am a fan of it.
Oh, okay, good. I'm in good company then, because I love Midsommar. I thought it was so good.
Agreed. I have a funny little anecdote about this movie, because when it first released in the cinemas, like, again, you know, I'd already seen Hereditary, so I was keen to see this. Mm-hmm. And I recall very vividly being at the cinema, and I was actually in the kind of bar of the cinema, and I was having a meeting with a colleague there.
Okay.
And she said to me, she's like, oh, what are you doing later? I'm like, well, since I'm at the cinema, I'm going to go and catch Midsommar, the late showing. And she goes, oh, Mary, don't see that. It is so traumatic. It is so horrible. Oh my God, please don't see that. It is so disgusting. And I'm like, I just looked at her and I'm like, I gotta be honest, you're really selling it to me right now.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, and it was exactly that. I was like, damn, like, I need to strap in for this, because this is getting crazy. Like, I love the entire cast. I mean, Florence Pugh. Wow. What?
This movie. Oh. This was the genesis of my major crush on Florence Pugh. This is the movie that caused Florence Pugh to displace Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Ramona Flowers from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World from the top of my celebrity crush list. So,
Understandably.
Florence Pugh, number one with the bullet.
Yeah, wow. I mean, she just pierces right through your soul. Mm-hmm. She's extraordinary. The concept of it is incredible. The setting is outrageous to me. The fact that all of this horror is taking place virtually always in bright sunlight.
It was advertised as a nightmare in the day.
A nightmare in the day. There you go. It's this very kind of almost paradoxical notion that you should be fearful in that, in the brightness of summertime, especially in a place like Sweden, where they have such long summer, you know, summer days. Mm-hmm. So it is just very anti, like, it seems very counterintuitive, you know, and yet that's what it's sort of like working with. And I love the final scene, and I just, I love this movie so much.
It's another one where Ari Aster takes you to the end and goes, here you go. Here is this climactic scene. I'm going to give you the, like, most, the traditional storytelling tradition is the climax comes a little bit before the end. Nope. Ari Aster says you get the climax in the last freaking frame. Here you go. This is what you're getting. And the ending is fantastic. Like, again, I sound like a broken record. If you haven't seen Midsommar, what are you doing? You need to go see it. But yes. I'm excited for this episode because, excuse me, the expert guest that I'm having on, this was a deep dig I had to do to get this guy. He is a professional rune reader. So he is able to interpret all the runes throughout the movie. So the movie, as you said, it takes place in the north of Sweden. So a lot of the movie is it has Nordic runes around the set. And I mean, it adds to the atmosphere, but a lot of times it's difficult to understand what they mean. This gentleman who I'll have on can read those runes and can tie them into the plot of the movie. So we're going to have him read those runes, talk about how they relate to the plot, and then we're going to do actual rune readings on the podcast. So that's going to be so much fun to have that dude on.
Oh my God, obsessed. That is so cool.
It's going to be neat. And actually, Midsommar was the first one I thought of to do this podcast, because this podcast, like I said, it's meant to be kind of a love letter to horror, but also a way to appreciate the horror movies that we love a bit deeper. And having a rune reader on, that gets right at the heart of what I want to do here.
Amazing. What a brilliant program. I love it.
Thank you, Mary. Okay, so we got two more to go, two very different movies. One is one of my... I wouldn't say one of my favorites, but I think one of the most fun movies that I've seen the last several years, that being Mandy, which is essentially a fever dream of death metal and slasher horror. How would you describe Mandy?
Mandy is bonkers. It is absolutely crazy and chaotic.
It is.
Nicolas Cage is a rather surprising entry for me as a great horror actor. And I never really took him that seriously in horror. Because he was in that one vampire movie. Do you remember back in, like, I think it must have been the late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Renfield, but no.
Vampire's Kiss, I believe it's called.
I know the movie, but I haven't seen it. I thought you were going to say the remake of... The Wicker Man.
Yes. Yeah. So what I was referring to is it is Vampire's Kiss, 1989. It is a very memeable movie. It's completely ridiculous.
Well, I mean, so is he.
Exactly. But somehow he's worked out this way of channeling his absurdism and his memeability to work in the progress and the advancement of horror rather than to ridicule it.
And he is the villain in the upcoming Long Legs, which I am absolutely amped for. Again, there's a lot of a real kind of runes and kind of codes in that movie that I'm excited for. But yeah, he's showed up in quite a few horror movies.
He has. Yeah, exactly. So I think that he is someone that is great for horror because he's an A-lister. So he's able to attract, you know, audiences that follow his career.
Right.
And they're going to get a taste of horror simply because they like him as an actor. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it's really mixing things up. And of course he was in that cosmic horror one, the Lovecraftian.
Oh, that was actually really fun. That was a fun movie too. Color Out of Space. Yeah.
Color Out of Space, exactly. So for me, Mandy is, I love that it is so blood-soaked and completely over the top. I love Andrea Riseborough. Wow, what an amazing actress. She is so good in it.
She's fantastic.
It's such a good balance of her very kind of like deep gravitas versus his verging on like psychotic.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's something else too about this movie that I think I haven't seen it mentioned in any discussions of the movie, but I think it's something that adds to it. So the movie has a very 80s feel to it, just on the basis of kind of there's some animation that has an 80s feel. But it also has a feel kind of like It Follows, in that it's very anachronistic. You can't really tell when this is taking place. I think the internet is there, if I'm remembering right, but it also feels very, very like early 80s in the Pacific Northwest. So it adds to kind of the off feel about it. But you're very right in that it's very blood-soaked and very unhinged. All I'm going to say, chainsaw fight.
My God.
Incredible. Incredible.
So satisfying to watch.
Yeah. And the last film that I'll be talking about this series, very much not Nicolas Cage-like, but also very scary, very dark. The talented Morphic Clark's in St. Maud. Which is one that I did not see coming at all, but completely knocked me over.
Oh, same. Absolutely. The director, Rose Glass, is a British filmmaker. She, of course, has just released her second film, Love Lies Bleeding. And in this, in St. Maud, I was immediately drawn to the idea of religious psychosis. And there's so much of intermixing of mind and body horror in this. And yeah, it just leaves you with a very strange feeling. It feels very uncanny to watch. Tonally, it's quite unique compared to everything else you've programmed for your series. So it's good that this is also getting a look in. There are some devastating scenes in this movie where
the last quarter second.
Oh my God. It feels like an absolute trip. Like, it is totally a mind trip,
which I can appreciate. Though I appreciate that the director didn't leave us hanging and wondering, that they answered the question as to what's going on, but they used the last quarter second to do it. And something that I'm very excited for the guests that I got for this episode as well, because like I said, most of the time my second guest is going to be just a friend of mine. Where we'll discuss the movie and just be fans of the movie and what it meant to us and such.
Yeah.
But for St. Maud, I have two experts in two very different areas. I have one individual who is a expert and and I guess, I don't even know what you would call it, but religious conversation. So she, this expert, she's not necessarily an expert in psychology, but she's an expert in guiding people to have better conversations with God. So she is a strong believer that people can have conversations with God. The other expert is a researcher, a medical researcher that talks about religious psychosis and actually studies the phenomenon of people believing that they're speaking with God and when they act on those beliefs. So I have kind of both sides. One person talking about, okay, people are actually talking with God, and the other one is that, no, they're just religious delusions. So we're going to get both sides of the St. Maud argument for that episode.
Ah, what a great idea to have those two sides interplaying in a debate like that. That's great.
Well, I'm not going to let them debate. It's one after the other, because that would get ugly. But all the same, they both seem they're both very learned in their respective fields, and I think they're both going to have something. They're going to have something to say about the movies. And I very much appreciate that both of them they appreciate the other side as well. And they're both, I wouldn't say fans of the movie, because both of them were like, it scared me, but that's kind of the idea. So. So that will round out the first series. So we have those 12 to go with the first series. And if more than a handful of people listen, we'll have a second series. But I'm going to see how this goes for this first go. And Mary, you are in no small part responsible for what's going to happen here.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I have to say, I think that we are doing some good work bridging the gap between psychologists and psychoanalysts.
Hell yeah.
and I really like the concept of your podcast. It's very different. it's different to what some other people are doing. It's unique, and I'm looking forward to listening.
Well, one thing I didn't want to do was just, I mean, I do just want to kind of fanboy out over these movies, and I can do that with, like, my friends and people like you, but I also want to have people who have kind of scientific insight into these movies and can add something to the movies for people who are fans of these movies. So fans of Midsommar, for example, like me, like you, we love that movie, but maybe we don't know what those runes say, and maybe they say something that'll give us an additional understanding about what's going on. So it's kind of opening Easter eggs throughout the movie by understanding it at a deeper level. I think it's going to be a ton of fun.
Definitely. Yeah. And I love the idea of geeking out over those details and learning more along the way and using the film actually as almost like an educational device to discover more.
Yeah, exactly. Because we've all seen these movies 100 times, but every time I watch one of these movies, I see something different. But now I want to see the things that I missed. So that's why I'm having these people who are much smarter and much more talented than me to come on and teach me about these things.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, and of course, we'll have you on anytime you want to come on.
Thank you so much.
And we will have you on for the invitation. I think that's going to be the third episode that drops, depending on how the schedule shifts around. But as I said, best laid plans of mice and men. But until then, I know people can find you. Well, actually, where can everybody find you? We said already, but please say so again.
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at PsychStar. And Patreon on patreon.com/MaryWild.
Yeah, and I would recommend everybody join that Patreon, because although the podcasting Mary does is top-notch, it's completely entertaining, so informative. Some of the things that only show up on your Patreon are so interesting. When you do just kind of individual analyses, when you do dream interpretation, things that are only available through your Patreon, getting access to your knowledge of Freudian psychology, it makes it so much fun. So anybody who's a fan of horror, who's a fan of psychoanalysis, you need to be following Mary Wild. So
thank you so much. That's very kind.
Of course. And thank you for coming on. And everybody, I hope you'll join next week, episode dropping each week, where we have our first actual episode of Dark Overtones. Given that The Witch probably got bumped, I'm going to say the first episode is going to be It Follows, but you can't hold me to that. If it changes, I reserve the right to change it. So thanks, everybody, and hopefully we'll tune in next week. Take care. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.